Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 27th of February, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish.
Well, we're going to get straight on with, well, what's going on in Pakistan and India, because obviously everybody will know by now that Pakistani airspace is closed to all air flights, commercial and military, and they shot down a couple of Indian, fighter jets. India claims to have shot down a Pakistani fighter jet. So it goes on. The Indian statement said the Pakistani Air Force was detected and the Indian Air Force responded instantly. In that aerial engagement, one Pakistan Air Force fighter aircraft was shot down by a MiG-21 of the Indian Air Force. The Pakistani aircraft was seen by ground forces falling from the sky on the Pakistani side. In this engagement, we have unfortunately lost one MiG-21. The pilot is missing in action, and Pakistan has claimed that he is in their custody. We're ascertaining the facts. Well, there have been a number of photographs posted on social media, Brian, showing a bloodied, what appears to be a bloodied Indian pilot. But Imran Khan saying that he thinks that talks should take place at this point, try to de-escalate the situation, but clearly it's not so great.
Well, it's incredible, isn't it? And of course, India and Pakistan have been such a volatile situation for so many years. With all the other problems going on in the world, it's remarkable that this is now flaring up.
Well, isn't it just... Now, of course, this is all about Kashmir, but it is remarkable timing. Anyway, in the meantime, this was in the Daily Mail. Carrying next to her dead sister, little girl lies covered in blood under rubble after latest bombardment by Assad's regime in rebel-held Syrian province. So the war party banging the war drums once again. Of course, where did all these images come from that are all copyright associated AFP and Reuters? They've come from the White Helmets. The hypocrisy, apart from anything else here, is unbelievable. Because, you know, they say airstrikes killed 5 people, including 3 children in northwestern Syria. President Bashar al-Assad forced thousands of civilians to flee in terror. Khan Shukun has turned into a ghost town despite being under ceasefire, and disturbing images show a bloodied girl cowering next to her sister's corpse. I would just remind everybody that we've seen these types of images before. These have all come from the White Helmets. You might describe them as the propaganda wing of al-Nusra Front. This is, in my opinion, Brian, some pretty egregious war propaganda. We've got to remember that the White Helmets have, of course, not been too shy about staging similar situations in the past. And really, the hypocrisy here is pretty tangible once again, because, of course, if we remind people how many civilians died through the Western-backed operation to clear Mosul of exactly these type of people, and also Raqqa. So there wasn't too concern on the Western side when we were trying to clear ISIS out of those areas, how many civilians got hurt or injured or killed as a result. But apparently when it's Assad and Russia that are trying to clear ISIS and other extremists out of part of Syria, then they're not allowed to kill any civilians. I have to say that if we're being objective about this, looking back at their past operations, Syria and Russia have done everything they could to make sure that they minimised civilian casualties. That's not something the West can ever claim.
This is true. We're in such serious times, Mike, because we're looking at mainstream media, the so-called quality media, and it's becoming more and more clear that we cannot trust any single article that they put up. Some are better or some are worse than others, depending on how you want to look at it. But of course, the BBC has got its own journalists now saying that the staged chemical attacks. And are these real or not? So it's beginning to break surface. Can we trust the BBC on these issues? No, I don't think we can. Can we trust our own government? No, I don't think we can. We'll be having a little look at Theresa May's performance a bit later in the news.
In the meantime, Donald Trump has arrived in Vietnam for his meeting with Kim Jong-un. Well, he's already met President Trong of Vietnam. He's also met Prime Minister Phuc of Vietnam. He's clearly doing some preparations for a dinner with Kim Jong-un this evening, a brief one-to-one conversation as well, and then the main summit scheduled for tomorrow. So Trump tweeted out, with complete denuclearization, North Korea will rapidly become an economic powerhouse. Without it, just more of the same. Chairman Kim will make a wise decision. But he then went on to highlight the fact that the mainstream media, of course, playing their usual tricks, all false reporting, guessing on my intentions with respect to North Korea. Kim Jong-un and I will try very hard to work something out on denuclearization and then making North Korea an economic powerhouse. I believe that China, Russia, Japan and South Korea will be very helpful. Well, in the meantime, of course, the British mainstream press, what are they up to? They're really making fun of Kim as much as they possibly can. Here he is smoking. Apparently, this is something extremely interesting that we should know about, that he takes the occasional drag on a cigarette. Of course, we also had headlines about him being surrounded by bodyguards. Another headline that his bodyguard missed his cue to get off the train and had to run quickly down the gangplank after Kim as they got off the train. Really, the British media coverage of this has been utterly pathetic.
That is quite a tweet, isn't it? It's the first time I've seen that particular tweet.
Yeah, but North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been filmed smoking a cigarette before boarding his train in, to Vietnam for the summit with Donald Trump. I mean,
this is a heinous crime. He was daring to smoke a cigarette when of course, the British government says people shouldn't smoke cigarettes.
No, well,
that's outrageous.
Just shocking. But anyway, in the meantime, in the United States, Michael Cohen is giving evidence to Congress. Apparently, the timing of this is spectacular. So this, of course, he's described in the mainstream press as being Donald Trump's former fixer and the personal lawyer. And he's going to give evidence today against Donald Trump to Congress. Among other things, he's accusing Donald Trump of being a racist, a con man, and a cheat, apparently. He said he'd be handing over documents to assert these to support these assertions. The timing of this, absolutely amazing. It's exactly the same type of operation that, what do we call them? U.S. deep state pulled when Trump met Xi Jinping. So they're attempting to ramp up the local, the domestic headlines to take any praise that Trump might, you know, deserve for trying to organize, you know, deal with some of these international issues, and take them down to the lowest possible level. So the timing is spectacular. Mainstream media, once again, right in the heart of driving forward a certain ideology and policy here.
Certain policy, and it's where that policy comes, which is the key bit. But I'll just say, Monday, Mike, I was watching UK column news and I was just fascinated with the video on the EU Arab League meeting. And I was watching our Prime Minister, and I decided to take some clips from the video which was shown in that UK column news, because I think it just gives us a little bit of a deeper insight into our illustrious Prime Minister Theresa May. So this is the sort of thing I put up. Now, I put some captions here because I wondered what she was thinking. But in this shot, Theresa May is top right on your screen. And she's got a very subtle, to my mind, forced smile. She's trying hard to smile that she's here with this illustrious group of people. And she should be smiling.
Everybody seems to have their backs turned.
Well, it gets worse, really. Let's follow it through, Mike, because this did fascinate me. Here she's turned away, and obviously we've got Frau Merkel in the foreground getting all of the attention. But you look at that expression on Theresa May's face, it's absolute blackness. She's not happy. She's turned away from all the jovial activity. And, I'm taking the mickey out of her here, that she's saying that Frau Merkel's getting all of the attention. But what's really happening? This is all to do with Theresa May. She's back having a little look. There's this little bit of a demure smile, but she's not really very happy. And then she does this. She's looking straight down at her feet. I'm told, whether it's true or not, that this is a sign of somebody who's sort of getting depressed. You're looking down at the ground. And to me, she's like a little girl at a party where the others aren't really playing with her. She's looking down at her feet. She'll be shuffling her feet and thinking, I wish somebody had come and take me away from this. But is this the quality of a prime minister that can actually lead this country out of the trap of the European Union? I don't think so. I think there's something very badly wrong here. Then you see this one when they've just about got ready for their photo shoot. And I found it extraordinary that I'm not sure who the gentleman is speaking to her, but she's watching him and listening to him. So it's not the British Prime Minister that's talking. She's very much on the back foot and in the listening position. But at least somebody is talking to her. But obviously that doesn't go well, because a little bit later she's back in this absolute black. You can almost see the black cloud around her. This woman doesn't know what to do at all. So she's not amongst these people leading a strong Britain out of the European Union. This is a woman who now can't cope because she's no longer got these false political EU friends around her. So if we jump from her to your favourite friend here, Mr. Tusk, I was just fascinated. If you watched him, we're seeing something very different. We're seeing an arrogant confidence. This little expression caught my mind. What was he actually thinking? Well, I've been a bit naughty and I've put in some things. He's smirking at the British because the EU policy is now wrecking this country. Of course, I don't know whether he was thinking that or not, but we just look at his face. And then it changed to this. And now we've got something really different coming into this man. Was he actually looking at Theresa? You can't really see, but he could be. And what would he be thinking? She deserves it. She's a traitor to the EU project.
That's actually an interesting caption you've put up there, Brian, because, of course, she's in the position potentially where Donald Tusk does consider her a traitor. She's also in the position where most of the British public consider her a traitor as well. So this is not a very nice place to be, it strikes me.
Not a nice place to be, and it's not a nice place with men like this controlling Britain via this EU empire, because this was another expression on his face, and I thought this is really showing us. If you look at the eyes and you look at the intent in that man's face, whatever's going on in his mind, it is not very nice. So Theresa May bringing Britain out of the European Union with Brexit, I don't think so. I think what we've got is a complete pack of lies to the British public, the electorate, as this whole thing is made more and more complex and delayed and stalled.
Well, and in fact, the nature of some of the problems that she has brought on this country will be published on the UK column this afternoon. Keep an eye out for a couple of new articles. Right. Now, just a quick reminder, if you like what we're doing and you'd like to support us, please do so. And you can do that at ukcolumn.org/community, and you can join us there. Quick reminder that AV9.1 DVDs are still available on the UK Column website. Presentations from Brian, from Alex Thompson, from Patrick Henningsen, Dr. Graham Downing, and from Ian R. Crane. And just to let everybody know that all the residential tickets for Alternative View 10, which is taking place in May, are now sold. There will be some very limited availability of day tickets at some point. But in the meantime, if you want to be put on the waiting list in case anybody drops out of a residential place, please do get in touch with Ian Crane via alternativeview.co.uk.
And the selling out must be a sign of more people now keen to mix and meet other people, other individuals who are questioning what the sort of
Absolutely.
Official line is on all matters of things. Right, well, we're just going to move on to this, which is a very sad report, but it takes us back to the 17th of March 2015, when the UK column put out a report about this gentleman, Quinton Duckworth. and he had been found dead on a railway line. And we were speaking to his brother at the time, who said nothing about this case stands up. The reports from the British Transport Police don't stand up. The reports from the police do not stand up. Effectively, this case was not investigated properly. And much of the background to it, where this particular gentleman, Quintin, was being bullied by the police, was never really brought to the surface or followed up. But his brother, Graham, who tried very hard over quite a lengthy time to get a proper investigation, to get a proper coroner's report into what happened, just found that as he pushed harder and harder for the truth to come out, so he got an even worse time. Now, Graham contacted us this morning to say today, the 27th of February 2019, is the anniversary of Quintin Duckworth's death. That death has never been properly investigated, but his brother Graham has just been released from prison after clearly being targeted for daring to challenge the cover-up. So we were asked if we'd put this report out today because it is the anniversary. And as I did so, of course, my mind is taken to the recent reports that David Scott has made of the deaths of young men in Scotland that have clearly not been investigated by Police Scotland. So we will stay on this case and report more. But I think this is another reflection that something very, very dangerous is now going on in UK, where the deaths of people not being properly investigated by the police. And we also know that in many cases, the deaths are not being properly investigated by coroners. And this is impacting as well on deaths of people within the NHS. So a very serious report from the column, but we will follow up because this is a very important factor of what's happening in UK today.
Now, over in Australia, as many people have seen, yesterday there was quite a furore because Cardinal Pell, very senior Vatican level member of the Roman Catholic Church, Cardinal Pell was finally announced that he had been found guilty of sexually assaulting two boys. In fact, that verdict apparently was handed down before Christmas, but it was just made public yesterday. And he left the court yesterday to a large crowd of reporters and also protesters. Well, it seems that for the Murdoch press, at least, this is a major miscarriage of justice. So this is the Guardian in Australia here reporting. News Corp columnists declare Cardinal Pell innocent and a scapegoat. And they're saying that Andrew Bolt and Miranda Devine say Cardinal George Pell's conviction was wrongful and accusations are implausible. So remember, this was a unanimous verdict by the jury. But apparently, as far as the Murdoch press in Australia is concerned anyway, that's not satisfactory. News Corp columnists Andrew Bolt and Miranda Devine led the charge in Wednesday's papers. This Guardian article reports characterising the guilty verdict as a wrongful conviction and likening it to when Lindy Chamberlain was wrongfully jailed for murdering her baby Azaria, and describing it as the O.J. Simpson case in reverse. They quote Bolt, who said, "Declaration, I have met Pell perhaps five times in my life and I like him." Bolt says, "I'm not a Catholic or even a Christian. He's a scapegoat, not a child abuser, in my opinion." So on the basis of five meetings with this man and a personal like for him, he has made this decision, apparently. And he said, as I've just said, he said, "This is, in my opinion, this is our own O.J. Simpson case, but in reverse. A man was found guilty not on the facts, but on prejudice." Well, if there was prejudice, and I'm not saying there was, but if there was prejudice, of course, part of the reason for that is that for many years, possibly a decade or so, Cardinal Pell has absolutely refused to leave the Vatican and return to Australia to face these charges. Now, perhaps if he had done that, perhaps there would not have been the publicity which had built up over many, many years over him, over the situation and so on. And if there's any question of the fairness of this trial, then perhaps it's only his own. He's only got himself to blame for that. I'm not saying there is any question over the fairness of this trial. I think the jury came to the correct decision. It was a unanimous decision. It is fascinating to me that it is the Murdoch press in particular that seems to be standing beside him here.
Yes, excuse me. And of course, he was able to take protection in the church at one stage.
Yes.
Added to the complexity. Let's follow through. Now, this was an article which came out a couple of days ago, but I believe is very, very significant. It's from the Mail. Theresa May allowed GCHQ spy chief to resign for family reasons after he helped paedophile Catholic priest avoid jail, despite the media being told he would be caring for a sick relative. I encourage people to read this this story because it's important to take in all of the facets of it. Essentially, we've got a man who, prior to him taking over the role of director of GCHQ, provided a reference for a man which allowed him to get away from a sentence in relation to paedophile activities. And then he later resigns and he says this: after a good deal of thought, I've decided that this is the right time to move on and to allow someone else to lead GCHQ through its next phase. My job demands a great deal of my ever patient and understanding family, and now is the right time for a change in direction. And what the press are really saying here is that this was the this was the scam which the government had created, because people were led to believe that he was just going as a result of family pressures. But the reality was that the National Crime Agency had discovered that he had provided this reference to a paedophile priest who, following that glowing reference, went on to commit further abuses, was able to go on. But the government, the British government, we've got this same thing, the government deciding that the British public shouldn't know the truth. And so this sob story was the one actually put out. Mm. But if you get into the story itself, and it is pretty graphic, so here it is. Mr. Hannigan provides a character reference for Father Edmund Higgins at his 2013 trial, and the priest gets an 8-month suspended sentence. The judge said Higgins had struggled with his sexuality, but he went on to reoffend. And in a minute, just a couple of minutes, we're going to look at what that reoffence was. The powerful Mandarin gave the reference in good faith a year before his appointment as director of the 5,000-strong government communications headquarters. Was there no positive vetting done here by the security services on this man, Mike? Of course there was. So that vetting knew of this connection, but he was still allowed to go through. I find this very, very, very interesting.
All right. So the timing is that he gave this reference before he went to work for GCHQ.
Yes, and then he goes into GCHQ. But when he resigns as a result of this starting to come to the surface, then it's all, I've got to resign because of pressures on my family.
Right.
So the detail here, the Mail on Sunday learned that number 10 was alerted in early 2017 that the National Crime Agency was investigating Higgins as part of a major probe into online chat rooms that hosted abuse of babies. We're into utterly disgusting stuff here. Mr. Hannigan offered to step down and avoid dragging GCHQ into the scandal, but the significant reason behind his departure was never made public. Even senior officials within the Foreign Office, GCHQ and the Cabinet Office were unaware. So this was an internal government cover-up. Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary with responsibility for GCHQ, at the heart of it. But of course, this goes through the heart of government.
Do you find it likely that the Cabinet Office was unaware?
I think the Cabinet Office as a whole, I think it's highly likely, Mike,
right,
because I think this tends to reinforce the idea that even the Cabinet Office is actually being controlled by something deeper within it. Mm. Maybe it's the Pearl Office, as we've mentioned before. But they caught the Father Edmund Higgins boasting online of his sexual interest in babies, and he later confessed to possessing and making child abuse images, which were horrific, 800 illegal images. And so all of this was there But the key point is that the government concealed it.
Mm.
The government concealed it, presumably in the public interest. Now, what the paper pointed out, and I think it was a very good point the journalist made, was that in 2017, when all the business with GCHQ was going on, Theresa May was quoted as saying this: the sunlight of transparency acts as an important check and balance and helps ensure the highest standards of public life amongst senior government representatives. This is duplicity, Mike, at an unbelievable level. Is it conceivable that a prime minister who says this, knowing what's going on in the background, could be trusted to get us out of the European Union? I don't think there's any way you could trust this this prime minister. This was a report from the London Economic, it's called. Theresa May and Amber Rudd suppress Westminster child abuse documents for national security reasons. And it's Labour MP Lisa Nandy. This was reported back in November 2017. She was revealing in Parliament embarrassing inconsistencies between Prime Minister Theresa May and the Home Secretary over documents, Home Secretary Amber Rudd, over documents being hidden from inquiry into allegations of child abuse by MP Cyril Smith. And one of the quotes is, the Home Secretary told me that some papers would be withheld from the Civil Smith inquiry for national security reasons, Nandy told the House of Commons. Yet she added, this week the Prime Minister has written to me to say we're clear that the work of the security services will not prevent information being shared with other such inquiries. But if we had a man running GCHQ who was providing positive references to paedophile priests, who knows who we can trust in this mess. So here's The Guardian, 17th of May 2015, Theresa May is Home Secretary. Cyril Smith cover-up claims could lead to prosecutions. We'll just take this paragraph. The Conservative Home Secretary also told a committee of MPs on Tuesday she hoped immunity from prosecution under the Official Secrets Act will be offered to former police officers and intelligence agents who are prepared to testify about allegations of paedophile rings and other child sex abuse to the police or to the government's separate public inquiry. But the same people were helping intelligence services actually to slip away, having been on the fringe, we'll say, to be kind to the gentleman, of this paedophile activity. And let's also remember that when John Wedger, the Metropolitan Police officer, stepped forward to warn about widespread abuse of children in London and the cover-up of that abuse by the Met, police, politicians, local authorities and charities, Theresa May's Home Office lost his files and evidence. Mm. Mike, could it actually be clearer that we have got a criminal elite running Westminster? We've talked about this business of child abuse being the engine. This is how the blackmail works. Can we trust this government on anything they say? Can we trust it on Brexit? Perhaps the European Union is blackmailing MPs using child abuse.
I don't know, but certainly this government has built up quite a reputation now for suppressing, covering up and preventing any serious investigation, particularly of child abuse linked to Westminster, but on a much broader basis as well.
Yeah. We'll stay on the case.
OK, so, well, let's move on to the Labour Party. And Chris Williamson, MP, is in a bit of hot water at the moment. He's being criticised for saying that the Labour Party has been too apologetic over the claims of anti-Semitism. He said that he suggested that the Labour Party response to complaints about anti-Semitism had contributed to the Labour Party being demonised. And so he's getting all kinds of trouble at the moment. Now, of course, Chris Williamson is the MP who put the questions into Parliament about the Integrity Initiative. So he seems like a reasonable guy. And frankly, I have to say, I totally agree. I think the Labour Party, Brian, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I think the Labour Party would have been much better to have simply taken a stand on this, to say that Being critical of the state of Israel, being critical of Israeli foreign policy, does not constitute anti-Semitism. And there's really no other activity within the Labour Party which could be described as anti-Semitism, not in any substantive way anyway. They don't have a systemic problem other than the fact that the Labour leadership and many people within the Labour Party are critical of Israel over the treatment of Palestinians.
Yeah, if Corbyn had stood up and actually said what he did believe, then he had something to defend. But of course, he didn't say anything. So the attacks have just continued to come in. But I think it is a very good thing that we're now starting to see at least some dialogue in the wider press and certainly the alternative press talking about the sheer power of Israel. This is not to do with anti-Semitism. What we're saying is, why is it that one nation state, Israel, has such a huge influence on the internal politics of not only the UK, but also the US? And this is not just about a viewpoint being put across by pro-Israel MPs, for example. We've got conservative friends of Israel, Labour friends of Israel, UKIP friends of Israel, all saying that they are there to lobby on behalf of Israel. David Cameron said that his loyalty to Israel was unshakable. That means his primary loyalty is to Israel, not the British people. I'd like somebody to explain to me what would happen if we had groups funded by the United Kingdom active within Israel, interfering in Israeli policy. The Israelis would say this is outrageous, get out, would they not?
Absolutely, and in the meantime, of course, we have the press vilifying Russia for interfering in Western politics when there's no evidence whatever that if it's happening at all, that it's even on a fraction of the levels that Israel is interfering in Western politics.
So I hear all the cries of anti-Semitism, but I'm not actually seeing the evidence to back up what that is. And if you're right, and what it is deemed to be is any criticism of what the state of Israel is doing, well, this is outrageous, because we should be able to criticise any state for doing things which are not right, whether it's America or it's Iceland or Italy or anybody else. So why this unique status? I don't understand it.
Absolutely. Well, of course, it's not just Britain. And Patrick Henningsen on this programme has been highlighting it's also happening in the United States and the Democratic Party now. But of course, France is also getting their fair share of this. So this is from Euronews. What is anti-Semitism and why is it spreading in Europe? So they are speaking to a lady called Pascal Aladev, who's director of the Jewish Museum in Brussels. And she was asked, what are the reasons behind the rise of anti-Semitism in France? And she said, the rise of anti-Semitism in France is everywhere in Western Europe, is a combination of anti-Semitism from the extreme left and the extreme right. Jews are seen as ideal scapegoats for all the problems of French society, economic difficulties, unemployment, climate change. Additionally, the resurgence of anti-Semitism is linked to the revival of conspiracy theories. Today, the release of hatred on social networks is moving to the streets. Anti-system discourse is a catalyst for anti-Semitic revival. Hate speech has been spreading for years on social media. So I have to say that if this is really the position that she's taking, then anti-Semitism is the gift that keeps on giving, because anybody that's criticising the economy of a nation, unemployment levels, climate change, anybody that's saying anything on social media which is outside the mainstream narrative is considered anti-Semitic. Really, this is potentially being used as the biggest shutdown of debate and discourse on a host of issues, and the attempt to link it to a revival of conspiracy theories. This is
it's outrageous.
Well, it's not only outrageous; it's extremely dangerous, because if we are going to allow this as the mechanism for shutting down debate on a whole range of issues, then, well, we're going to find ourselves in trouble. I mean, serious trouble, very, very quickly.
And the other thing we need to bring in here, to probably just to finish this segment, Mike, is that when Jewish people criticise Israel themselves, then they are vilified in a particularly horrific way. We've seen this happen to Gilad Atzmon. And there's a book written by Gerhard Menuhin, Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil. It's a very thick book. It's extremely detailed, many references, very well written. But it's talking and challenging many of the things that we've been led to believe about politics in Europe, essentially since the end of the Second World War, some before. But even he's run into problems because he's asking questions and challenging conventional wisdom about a lot of political matters. So it's a very strange situation that even where you are Jewish yourself, woe betide you standing up and criticising elements of whatever it is, Zionism or Israel, because the next minute they're going for you. I don't understand it. I think there's a lot more to be looked at here.
Okay, well, let's change the subject completely and move on to, the use of modern technology in what's becoming a police state, perhaps. Police facial recognition, ethical issues. It has arisen out of a letter of May 2018 to the Biometrics and Forensics Ethics Group, to their policy sponsor, a guy called Alex McDonald. And they were asked to consider police use of facial recognition systems. And in response, they commissioned a report, which was released today, which outlines a framework of ethical principles that should be taken into consideration when developing policy on the use of live facial recognition technology for policing purposes and when designing trials of the technology. Now, what's I find it a bit interesting about this is that it focuses on the use of technology in relatively controlled environments, what they're describing as relatively controlled environments. So they're talking about public spaces where people are gathered and relatively static, for example, in a concert venue or in a sports stadium or at a public rally. They would have clearly defined entry and exit points where people would be channeled past the cameras. But of course, the trials of this that we've seen in the mainstream press so far have not been in that sort of situation. They've been in this one was being held at Stratford Station, where people are coming in and out, not necessarily through barriers, but are milling around, and so on. This particular headline from The Independent saying police stop people for covering their faces from facial recognition cameras and then fine a man £90 after he protested. He was fined £90 because he swore at the police for attempting or to giving him a hard time about the fact that he covered his face. There's no requirement in this country for somebody to have their face uncovered if they're cold, for example, or in fact, if they don't want their photograph taken, it's perfectly reasonable. But anyway, let's have a quick look at the areas. Public interest. They're saying the use of this technology is permissible only when it's being employed in the public interest. I'd like to see some
kind of... It's not the same public interest that you don't tell people that there are paedophiles loose.
Well, exactly, yes. I'd like to know what the definition of that is. Effectiveness, the use of the technology can be justified only if it's an effective tool for identifying people. The avoidance of bias and algorithmic injustice. So for the use of technology to be legitimate, it should not involve or exhibit undue bias. This can be unjust in two ways. First, some kinds of misrecognition or inherently demeaning and insulting. And second, technology with these biases can result in unequal and discriminatory treatment of some individuals. Okay. Impartiality and deployment. If the technology is deployed for policing purposes, it must be used in an even-handed way. So it should not be used in ways that disproportionately target certain events but not others, without compelling justification. Again, the compelling justification is not defined. Impartiality, accountability, oversight, and the construction of watch lists. So you're not allowed to use it to construct watch lists, apparently, if you want to be ethical. I'm quite sure that...
Does anybody believe that is not going on?
No, like, I don't think anybody does.
We've got the government repeatedly saying that anybody that dares challenge the government, even if it's on climate change, is effectively going to be on a watch list.
Absolutely, but they're saying that the construction of watch lists need to be subject to oversight by an independent body.
appointed by the government.
Absolutely. So it's going to be hugely independent. Public trust. If the technology is used for policing purposes, it's important that those using it, either in operational deployments or trials, engage in public consultation and provide the rationale for its use. Yes. And finally, cost effectiveness. So any evaluation of this, I'm not quite sure how cost effectiveness is an ethical issue, but there you go. Any evaluation of this technology has to take into account whether any resources it requires would be better used elsewhere. Well, in the meantime, the United Nations was pushing this out today, and it was originally published in December, but they were pushing it out today via their Twitter account and other places. And it's all about the ethics of artificial intelligence. Ethics apparently has suddenly become a very important part of this this discussion. But actually, when you read the text of this article in the UN Chronicle, really what it comes down to is that this is a tremendous opportunity, they say, for sustainable development. AI could open up tremendous opportunities for achieving the sustainable development goals set by the United Nations in the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. So if you're looking at this issue of ethics of artificial intelligence with a preconceived ideology in mind, which is in this case the sustainable development goals, are you going to get some kind of objective ethical outcome? I don't think so.
No, but if sustainable development is about actually removing very, very large numbers of human beings, then of course AI is exactly what we want.
Yes, well, okay, that's a fair point. Now, let's come back to the UK and, well, the wonderful world of British TV. This is BritBox. It's been in operation for a while in the United States and Canada, and it is a joint venture by the BBC and ITV to bring British television to the United States and Canada. And you'll be delighted to know that they're going to bring it to the UK as well. So BBC director Tony Hall, director general, sorry, Tony Hall, said that the aim was to launch BritBox in the UK in the second half of 2019. It's probably going to be something around £5 a month. It's there to be in competition, apparently, with Netflix and possibly Amazon. It's going to bring the best of British creativity, apparently, to people's homes. This is fantastic stuff.
Miss Marple and Jonathan Creek.
Yes, exactly. Yes, the new venture apparently is not intended to replace the iPlayer or ITV Hub. On-demand services where, well, this is what the BBC said, the on-demand services where programmes are available for a restricted period of time. So just so that everybody understands, the licence fee that you are already required to pay, unless you're actually not paying it, of course, entitles you to watch BBC programming, including what's on the iPlayer, but they are going to launch a platform in the UK, which means that you can give them an extra fiver a month in order to continue to watch BBC programs if you want to stream them online. Of course, what we're actually seeing here, and the reason that I'm interested in it, because frankly I'm not interested in watching Miss Marple or Jonathan Creek, but what we're seeing is the consolidation of the media in Britain. This is a joint venture between the BBC and ITV. They say that this is going to the to Ofcom and the Competition Authority for adjudication by them. But it's where, you know, and they're saying that they're building this in order to compete with Netflix. But is this appropriate? I don't think so.
Why is the BBC competing with anybody? It's in a unique position of sucking in nearly £4 billion worth of taxpayers' money. But if we're now mixing the government's favourite propaganda arm, the BBC, with more commercial interests, this is fascism, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, we'll end very quickly on this one. Pointed out to us that basically we got British MPs sitting on what ITV News describes as an all-party parliamentary group. They're investigating the resurgence of the anti-vaccination movement. This article from Age of Autism is warning that, well, this group isn't really a parliamentary committee. When you dig into it, it's linked with some very interesting organisations. One of them is called Results UK. And this article says that is in turn a satellite of Gavi, which we all know is a partnership of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. the World Health Organization, UNICEF, the World Bank, and the pharmaceutical industry, etc. Now, I didn't have long to look into this, but we followed through the ITV report, and that's absolutely correct. And here we see clearly that there's the lining up of some form of attack on anybody who dares challenge vaccines. Yes, the all-parliamentary group exists. We need to look deeper into the individuals on that group. But this is where it gets interesting, because their registered contact is actually through Results. The public inquiries point is through Results. And I spoke to Results very briefly before we went live to ask them exactly how this system worked. Essentially, they said they were totally independent, but they're just there to help these MPs. I'm paraphrasing. I asked if there were direct connections between Results and the pharmaceutical industry, and they said there wasn't, but we can see them working in partnership with organisations who are. When I pointed out that their own website seemed to indicate they were lobbying, they said, oh, no, we're not. We're simply, it's advocacy. So if you'd like to go and have a look at it and make up your mind on what's happening and why these people are involved with MPs, this is the sorts of things that they say about themselves. Results is a movement of passionate, committed, everyday people. We use our voices to, quote, influence political decisions. But that's not lobbying.
That's not lobbying.
They told me specifically that is not lobbying under the rules of lobbying. So I'll take that. But it is interesting that this organisation is influencing policy. And I found it fascinating. We've got a gentleman, Nigel Ward, who's been the board of trustees. He's got a background in the automotive industries, where he led on automation and robotic projects for a number of global companies that are not named. And he's got a particular interest in the growth and development of Results. How does that work? I don't know. But you can see all of the information and where it leads if you follow through. And eventually you'll see information on Gavi. So we're just saying at this point, it's fascinating that we've got ITV describing an all-parliamentary group looking at this subject. But of course, ITV doesn't delve into who are the people helping the MPs in this particular work. We'll leave it there. Final note, just to say, really excellent 5G meeting in Buckfast Lee, Devon on Friday evening. Probably 220 people in the room for the actual presentations and film clips on 5G. At least 50 people, unfortunately, had to be turned away. And we also know that several hundred people were also watching that being live stream. So I've got to say, Mike, really tremendous meeting. Well done for everybody turning up. And I was very interested to hear the reaction of some of the people in the audience who clearly knew nothing about the dangers of 5G before they started to hear the talks and presentations. And they were people who left at the end of the evening saying they were absolutely willing to help do something to alert other people. So a very good evening, and it was very professional. It just shows what can be done. Mm. Thanks for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Friday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.